From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Ukraine rebels vote in a controversial election. After balloting, Tunisia faces a variety of challenges. U.S. candidates are making final pleas for votes. And Iraq says Islamic State militants killed more than 300 members of an Iraqi tribe. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine have elected a separatist leadership in controversial elections that Kiev and the West say they will not recognize. The acting prime minister of the so-called Donetsk People's Republic, or DNR, had a commanding leader to become DNR leader. The United Nations, the European Union, and the United States have called the rebel vote illegal, saying it violates Ukraine's constitution and the ceasefire agreement reached September 5th between separatists and Ukraine's government. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko called the election in the separatist region a farce that is being conducted under the threat of tanks and guns. Russia's foreign ministry released a statement late Sunday saying it respected the separatist vote as an expression of the will of the inhabitants of southeastern Ukraine. John Bessemers, a European analyst with the Australian National University, suggests Moscow's heightened belligerence may be a sign of growing frustration with Western sanctions.
You'll recall a few months ago when the Donetsk and Luhansk people wanted to organize their referenda on independence that Putin discouraged them publicly. They went ahead and had it nonetheless, but it wasn't really recognized too explicitly by the Kremlin. This time, on the other hand, they seem to be fairly forthcoming with their recognition, and I think it's a stick in somebody's eye, and only two or three guesses as to who that might be. It's a sign in particular, I suspect, that they were hoping that by making nice for a while with the ceasefire and so on, that sanctions would be eased, because the Russian economy is just starting to squeak a little bit, and I think they would be very happy to see some easing of it. Economists, including the serious economists that there still are in the Putin administration, are warning that the country is likely to go into recession quite soon. On present indications, they have a lot of very negative trends running in parallel in the economy.
This comes at the same time amid reports of increased Russian Air Force activity around NATO countries. Do you see a change in Russian policy?
Yes, the aircraft activity is very worrying, but it's not new. It has turned into a bit of a perfect storm in recent weeks, but it has been going on for quite some time. Russia has been adopting very belligerent attitude towards the West as a whole, and I'm not sure to what extent this particular pattern of activity relates specifically to the elections or to even to Ukraine. It's all part of a broader picture, I think, of Russia seeking to regain its sphere of privileged interest, if we may use that term again that Medvedev popularized at one stage, which I think is a kind of Soviet Union light, L-I-T-E, but with other structures, obviously. Putin has said that it's impossible to reconstitute the Soviet Union, although he regrets very much its passing. But I think some kind of substitute organization directed and controlled to a large extent by Moscow is what he's after. And this aggression is all aimed at informing the West to get out of the way. Don't mess with us, as Putin has been saying recently. His speeches have been very belligerent, and I think he's trying to carve out a space which the West will recognize and not intrude into, and Ukraine is part of that space.
Well, does the attention now in Ukraine turn back to the battlefield from the ballot box?
Well, it's never really gone away from it, in a sense. I think there's something like, between 300 and 400 people are known to have been killed, I think, in the few weeks since the ceasefire. So it's been a ceasefire more in name than in reality. I think more of the pressure is coming from the Russian and proxy side. I don't think Kiev is too keen on more fighting at this point. I think Poroshenko found, after those months in which the Ukrainians were making inroads into the landholdings of the proxies in the east, they were making quite considerable inroads, but then Russia staged basically another invasion with several thousand forces, crack forces as well, and high-quality weaponry, which turned around the fortunes of the conflict completely. And since then, I think Poroshenko has recognized that he can't win this, that not by force, that he has to play it longer. And I think the proxies and the Russians, for their part, are looking to threaten some key strategic points, like, for example, the city of Mariupol, which is an important port city and one that's held by the, has been held fairly securely by the Ukrainians, but has been under a good deal of attack. Also the Donetsk airport, of course. So I think the Russians are maintaining the pressure, and they can increase the pressure at any time they like.
Besmer says Russia's aim appears to be another frozen conflict that puts more Ukrainian territory within Moscow's sphere, similar to what occurred in Georgia in 2008. He also says Russian aggression may turn to Moldova, where it does not want to see the current pro-Western government have another chance at forming a new government. Nida Tunis, or Tunis Calls Party, won 85 out of 217 seats in parliamentary elections, leaving Ennahda Islamist Party, that won the 2011 elections, a close second with 69 seats. While this advances the democratic transition in Tunisia, it leaves the country with a variety of challenges. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy discussed the issue with William Lawrence, director of Mideast and North Africa programs at the Center for the Study of Islam.
The parliamentary elections are landmark elections, primarily because these are the first elections after the development of after the passage of the new constitution. The first elections were for a transitional government that had limited power, and prior to the reforms that began with the new constitution. This new parliament is going to have to reconnect a wonderful, progressive new Tunisian constitution to laws which are completely out of step with that new constitution. So making the new Tunisia. So this is really, really important, not only symbolically with the development of democracy in the Arab world, but also in terms of the work that this parliament has to do to make Tunisia work again.
What's next in Tunisia, and what kind of challenges that the Tunisian transition would face in the next stage?
Tunisians go back and forth between believing that security is the biggest threat or economy is the biggest threat, and they're both the biggest threats. On the security side, you have homegrown terrorism, you have 3,000 fighters in Syria, hundreds coming back now, many of them disillusioned with what they saw, but coming back and maybe being disillusioned in Tunisia again for the reasons that they left. You have the threat from Libya, you have fighting on the west border of Tunisia, the Shanbi Mountains, and a certain amount of radicalism that hasn't really had its demands met by not only a Tunisian revolution that produced sort of a normally operating democracy, but also the defeat of the Islamist Party in the in these elections, which will further radicalize some young Tunisians. I think for me the bigger issue is 84% of Tunisians right now are dissatisfied with the economy, and many who voted and didn't vote were voting for jobs, were voting for livelihoods, and no political party in Tunisia has really articulated an imaginative new program to take Tunisia forward economically, and so that's going to have to be worked out after the elections.
Taking all these challenges into consideration, would Tunisia still serve as a model of how democracy can work in the Arab world?
Yes. I think there's been a kind of unhelpful debate going on about whether or not Tunisia is a model, and part of that debate is the fact that Tunisians will often tell you the homogeneity of Tunisia, the long constitutional history of Tunisia, the size of the country, the culture, whatever, make Tunisian democracy inherently better. I would say I don't agree with that. One thing that was important in the Tunisian transition was stronger institutions, and that helped Tunisia vis-a-vis, say, Libya. But Egypt had equally strong institutions with similar problems as Tunisia, and Egypt didn't make a successful transition. And so these facile explanations don't really explain much. For me, the most important thing is that the political class of Tunisia, when they were faced with a failure of their revolution in the second half of 2013, the government was in crisis. They worked it out, first behind the scenes and then more and more publicly, between what went from an informal to a formal national dialogue leading to the choice of a new prime minister who wasn't elected and the passage of a remarkable constitution with well over 90% of the votes in parliament. This meant that people worked together, and that will be the answer in Libya, it will be the answer in Egypt, and it will be the answer in Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. So whether or not you call this an example or a model or whatever, political dialogue and political inclusivity really matter when it comes to progress towards democracy.
William Lawrence, Director of Middle East and North Africa Programs at the Center for the Study of Islam. Across the United States, candidates are making final pleas for votes ahead of midterm elections Tuesday. At stake, which party will control each house of the U.S. Congress for President Obama's final 2 years in office? VOA's Michael Bowman reports the latest public opinion surveys show an electorate that seems to be swinging towards Republicans as campaigning draws to a close.
It is crunch time for candidates seeking to rally supporters and convince any remaining undecided voters. Georgia Democratic Senate candidate Michelle Nunn.
We are reminding everybody about their power to make a difference in this election by getting out and voting.
Both parties have deployed their biggest names to the campaign trails. Former Republican presidential contenders Mitt Romney and John McCain. And on the Democratic side, former President Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Notably absent from most Democratic campaigns, President Obama, whose declining approval numbers have vulnerable Democratic lawmakers distancing themselves from the White House.
It's good to be back in Michigan.
Even so, Mr. Obama did make a campaign appearance in Michigan last week.
I want to tell you why you need to vote. This country has made real progress since the worst economic crisis of our lifetimes. Over the past 4.5 years, we have seen American businesses create more than 10 million new jobs. Over the past 6 months, our economy has grown at the fastest pace in more than 10 years.
Political analyst Norm Ornstein.
Barack Obama finds himself in the same kind of position that Bush did 6 years ago. For an awful lot of his own candidates, persona non grata, except for raising money. They love the money. They don't want to have the president side by side with them.
Republicans, on the other hand, are eager to tie their Democratic opponents to the president. Senate candidate Scott Brown in New Hampshire.
The Obama-Shaheen agenda ends right here, right now.
Republicans are widely expected to retain control of the House of Representatives. In the Senate, they would need a net gain of 6 seats to seize control from Democrats.
We have a fairly clear idea that the trends favor, as they would normally, the Republican Party. The party out of the presidency does well in midterms. It's a tough road for Democrats. There's a route to get to keeping your majority. Republicans have multiple routes to taking a majority.
Democrats tout a massive voter mobilization effort they say will prove the polls wrong. Republicans, meanwhile, are sounding increasingly confident of victory on Tuesday. As always, those who show up to vote get the final say. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Iraq says Islamic State extremists have executed more than 300 members of an Iraqi tribe in western Anbar province, including women and children, whose bodies were found stuffed in a water well. Witnesses say the killings targeted members of the Sunni Abu Namir tribe. Additionally, Iraqi human rights officials speaking Sunday said 65 members of the tribe have been kidnapped after battling IS fighters for weeks before running out of ammunition. Western News reports, quote, senior tribal leader Sheikh Naeem al-Gaoud is saying he had repeatedly asked the Baghdad government for more men and weapons, but he said no action was taken. Stephen Zunis, a Middle East analyst at the University of San Francisco, told VOA's Victor Beatty the Sunni militants will even go after fellow Sunnis who take up arms against them.
This horrific massacre underscores the fact that what ISIS considers to be infidels is not simply non-Muslims, not simply non-Sunnis, but anybody who disagrees with their cult, with their totalitarian rule. The tribe is among a number of Sunni tribes in the area that has resisted the ISIS takeover. They had asked, as had the other militia from these tribal areas, to get support from the Baghdad government, but the Baghdad government itself, dominated by Shiite sectarians, who themselves have been accused of lesser massacres against Sunnis, have refused. So they've been in a vulnerable position. And when they have risen up, they have often been defeated. In this case, they were rounded up and massacred.
It would seem that the goal of the IS mass executions is to quash the opposition, whether Sunni, Shia, or other. Will this do that, or do you think this might actually generate further opposition to their advance?
They've already alienated large numbers of people who were initially welcomed, or at least tolerated, their takeover, given years of repression by the U.S.-backed government in Baghdad. They had hoped that this Sunni group would at least improve their lives somewhat, but of course they're quickly recognizing that this is another thing altogether. So I can only imagine this will encourage opposition, but whether it will make people basically cower given the brutality or inspire them to rebel remains to be seen. One of the problems, of course, is that the best hope of defeating the IS, just like the what happened in defeating their predecessor, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, was empowering the Sunni tribes to do the fighting themselves. If the fight against IS is led by the sectarian Shiite government or by Kurds or by the United States or other foreign forces, it can in many ways play into the hands of ISIS, which claims to be supporting the Sunni Arabs against these outside threats. But if it comes from within Sunni Arab population, it can be a much more potent political force. So the question is whether these tribal groups will be supported by the Baghdad government in order to do the fight themselves.
At the same time, along the Syria-Turkey border, some 150 Iraqi Peshmerga fighters were preparing to bolster fellow Kurds in battling IS for the town of Kobani. This after Turkey relented and allowed them to cross the border into northern Syria. How significant is this?
The Syrian Kurds have done a remarkably good job, given that they were outgunned and initially outnumbered, in resisting a total takeover of the city by advancing IS forces. These reinforcements don't add a lot of numbers, but they do add some heavy equipment and could help push back the remaining IS forces from the outskirts. So it could be a significant strategic shift.
Syrian Kurdish militia have put up a stubborn defense of the town, bolstered by U.S.-led coalition airstrikes aimed at IS targets, with Kobani now viewed as a symbol of resistance to the Sunni radicals. Appearing on U.S. television Sunday, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power praised American and British efforts for helping turn the tide against Ebola in Liberia. She also spoke about the biggest need in the fight against Ebola.
The number one need, I would say, is health professionals, nurses. Jim Kim from the World Bank came out a couple days ago and said as many as 5,000 would be needed in the coming months. That's a large number when you think about how many people have to take away from their practices, make themselves available for 3 or 4 weeks. Right now, the Ebola treatment units that the United States is helping build in the countries in the region are staffed. Most of the NGOs you talk to can say, okay, we can see the next month getting covered in terms of healthcare workers, but we don't know what we're going to do for the month after that.
The U.S. military team in Liberia has set up mobile labs to test for the virus, built a 25-bed hospital for health workers, and is building Ebola treatment units. U.S. federal investigators say the descent system of Virgin Galactic's passenger spaceship was prematurely activated before last week's fatal accident. The acting chairman of the National Transportation Safety Board, Christopher Hart, told reporters Sunday night the spaceship's two co-pilot unlocked the ship's feathering system before it reached the proper speed. The system is designed to decrease the spaceship's speed as it re-enters the atmosphere. But Hart insisted it is too early to assume the feathering system played any role in the disaster. He had said the ship's engine and propellant tanks were found intact, indicating there was no explosion. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey, reporting to you from Washington.
This is Today in History. On November 3rd, 644, Umar ibn al-Khattab, the second Muslim caliph, was killed by a Persian captive in Medina. Umar, who is regarded as the architect of the Islamic Empire, had taken over a large part of Persia. He is considered one of the most influential figures in Islamic history. In 1534, the English Parliament passed the Act of Supremacy, making King Henry VIII head of the Church of England, thus removing the official church in England from the realm of Roman Catholicism. Henry had sought the separation after the Pope refused to grant him a divorce. On this date in 1903, Panama declared its independence from Colombia. A treaty was quickly signed, granting the United States possession of the Panama Canal Zone, a waterway connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. The canal opened in 1914. In 1911, one of the world's most recognized brands of American automobiles entered the market to compete with the Ford Model T. Co-founded by Louis Chevrolet and William C. Durant, Chevrolet unveiled the Classic 6 touring sedan. In 1957, the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 2, the second spacecraft launched into Earth orbit, and the first to carry a living animal, a dog named Laika. Also on this day in 1957, the song At the Hop was released by a rock group known as Danny and the Juniors. At the Hop went to number one thanks in part to the group's appearance on American Bandstand, a national TV show featuring pop music and dancing. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power recently presented the Leo Nevis Human Rights Award to former Australian High Court Judge Michael Kirby. Justice Kirby won the prize for promoting human rights in North Korea through his work on the U.N.'s Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea. Created in March 2013, the commission was charged with conducting an in-depth investigation of the human rights situation in North Korea. Upon being refused permission to enter North Korea to investigate abuses firsthand, Justice Kirby and the two other commissioners sought the next best alternative. They made it a priority to hear directly from North Koreans who had personally experienced the regime's repression. More than 200 victims, eyewitnesses, and former officials provided testimony to the commission, and 80 witnesses participated in its public hearings. The first witness to speak publicly before the commission was Shin Dong-hyuk, who had been born into a detention camp. He recounted how, as a small child in the camp, he saw a 7-year-old girl stop for a random inspection. A guard found a few grains of food in the girl's pocket and proceeded to beat her with a wooden stick until she was unconscious. That little girl died the next day. A former guard from another camp named An Myung-chul told the commission that guards routinely raped prisoners. On one occasion, he said, when superiors learned that a guard had raped an inmate, the victim was taken to a detention house and tortured using fire. Then she was sent to perform punishing labor in a mine, all for the crime of having been raped. Under Justice Kirby's leadership, the commission assembled clear evidence that the abuses constituted a systematic, widespread, and grave pattern of crimes against humanity. The commission concluded these crimes were driven by policies established at the highest level of state. That finding, said Ambassador Power, will be essential to eventually holding the perpetrators of these unspeakable crimes accountable. By revealing the horrors the North Koreans have endured at the hands of their government, Justice Kirby has done a great service to the North Korean people. He has made a tremendous contribution to the cause of global justice by tirelessly pressing the international community to stop these atrocities and to bring those responsible to account.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.